From Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology News, this is the GenCast Network. Bringing you compelling and in-depth interviews with the biotech industry's leading researchers, newsmakers, and thought leaders. Sponsored by Eppendorf AG, the leading global supplier of biotechnology systems and research tools, employing more than 1,900 people worldwide. Eppendorf products include pipettes, pipette tips, Eppendorf tubes, and centrifuges, in addition to instruments and consumables for DNA analysis. Visit www.eppendorf.com to learn more about Eppendorf's DNA analysis and qPCR solutions. This week on the GenCast Network, Gen's Editor-in-Chief John Sterling talks to Nobel Prize winner Dr. Kerry Mullis about the invention of PCR.
Dr. Kerry Mullis is best known for his invention of the polymerase chain reaction technology, or PCR, which won him the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 1993. He has also won many other scientific awards, including the prestigious Japan Prize. Dr. Mullis received his B.S. in chemistry from the Georgia Institute of Technology in 1966, and a Ph. degree in biochemistry from the University of California at Berkeley in 1972. Dr. Mullis joined Cetus Corporation as a DNA chemist in 1979. It was during his 7 years there that he conducted research on oligonucleotide synthesis and invented PCR. He is a former director of molecular biology at Zitronix and has consulted for numerous biotech and pharmaceutical firms. Dr. Mullis also serves on the board of scientific advisors of several companies. Dr. Mullis, when did you decide to become a scientist?
Well, you know, I thought about that when you sent me this letter, and I said, well, you know, I didn't ever decide, and I don't know how many other people are like this, but I have a feeling that most really, you know, creative scientists at least, don't decide. That they sort of like, they have this kind of a combination, they're just born with this combination of curiosity, skepticism, like a certain amount of natural intelligence, you know, so they do well in elementary school and the sort of science related. I think I was always a scientist, and I think, you know, when I was out on our back porch in Columbia, South Carolina, you know, there was a regular washing machine dryer out there, and I can remember, you know, at about six, you know, starting to realize that little wheel on the front of it that my mother would turn, make it start and do things, and that thing would slowly turn. I was wondering, how does that make the washing machine work? You know, how does it, my mother never worried about that just as long as it worked, you know, but I knew that somehow that thing had to be connected to all these other little things, and you know, that defines you as a scientist kind of person, if you feel those kind of, you know, that's the kind of thing I spend my whole day doing that kind of stuff.
In your wonderfully delightful book, Dancing Naked in the Minefield, you wrote that you created PCR not to revolutionize biochemistry, but to use it as a tool to do an experiment. You went on to say that if you had had more knowledge about what you were doing, PCR never would have been invented.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Well, like, for instance, when I was saying it, you know, if I had known that if you want to get rid of nucleotide triphosphate, the cheapest way to do that is with, like, bacterial alkaline phosphatase, which knocks all the phosphates off of them. And what I didn't know, I knew you could do that, but what I didn't know, and neither did anybody else at the time, I mean, nobody had ever thought about it, is that you can heat denature it afterwards. Okay, so, you know, in my dilemma there, I wanted to get rid of the triphosphates, but then I wanted to add back fairly expensive alpha-labeled P32 triphosphate, which I was going to use in the experiment. So I didn't want that to get chewed up. And I didn't want any alkaline phosphatase in there. And I wanted this to be a one-tube kind of a thing that somebody in a hospital can run. And what I didn't realize is that you can actually do that. If you, instead of putting zinc in the buffer, you just use the enzyme as it is with the zinc in it, and it runs, it works for a few minutes without any zinc in the buffer, and then it does its job, and then you just heat it up, it loses its structure, and it loses its zinc. And if you hadn't put in like 20 millimolar zinc yourself, it will not renature. So I didn't have to use the polymerase twice. I didn't really have to, and if I'd have known that, I think I would have just said, oh, okay, here's a good way to get rid of that. I was driven on. I might not have noticed because it was because I didn't know that you could do that. I didn't know that for another year or two. I was doing another experiment where I discovered that. But, I mean, it was up. I mean, the paper that had showed that the secondary structure of alkaline phosphatase could be refolded if you just, like, heated it up and then cool it off, as long as you gave it zinc. The part that where the guy that had discovered or had purified that and discovered it, I forget his name, but he had put zinc in the buffer because he knew that zinc was important. See, I didn't quite understand, but yeah, but you can get one shot out of alkaline phosphatase without the zinc because it has its own. It'll quickly lose it, but by then you're through. If I'd have known that, I would just say, well, throw in alkaline phosphatase. Also, what I didn't understand, which was probably more, I think, global and more significant, is that there's a huge difference between 6,000 base pairs and 3 billion in terms of any kind of an analytical reaction you want to do on it, which only involves one particular sequence. You know, that's the problem that PCR solved. Now, that's not a problem anymore. If you want to deal with one sequence from the human genome, you amplify with PCR, and you've got as much of that particular sequence as you want. But back then, there wasn't such a thing available. And what I was proposing was an experiment that really, you know, the one with just one oligo in there and didn't use any cycling and was just depending on the fact that oligonucleotide would find a specific spot. That wouldn't have worked. I mean, I would have gotten a band in all four lanes. Like if you do a dideoxy experiment, you get a band in all four lanes. You know that, you know, if you've got like a something's wrong. It's supposed to be just one band in each lane. And this thing, what would have happened here is that the oligonucleotide would have landed on lots of different spots in the whole DNA sample.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
I do. Hey, in your book, you also note that initially, many researchers did not seem particularly excited by the potential of PCR. In fact, Nature and Science, as you write in the book, rejected your paper on the technology. Why was the scientific community unable to understand the power of the technique at that time?
Well, you know, everybody in the scientific community was not. But most of them didn't quite, you know, most of the scientists that I know today, in fact, they're not terribly open to something that's really shockingly different, you know. I think that was one thing. There's also a whole long story that I could, like, maybe one day write a book about, because it involves a whole lot of people, and some of them were not terribly nice, in my opinion, that could have, in fact, made sure that my first paper to Nature did get accepted. Yeah, there were some people around. There was the problem first with it can't happen here, so. The people at CETUS, the people who were my bosses and stuff at CETUS, they weren't really expecting anything colossal to come out of where they were. You know, that's sort of a common, it should come from somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
So there was that. So that made the early days before the proving of a thing working. Those things, that was very frustrating. I thought when I first got back there on a Monday morning, fairly early for me, with this notion that you could amplify DNA, and these pictures that I was drawing on everything, I thought everybody would be interested, but in fact nobody was. You know, it's just like, it's funny how conservative scientists are, and especially when you're like if, see, this, I was an organic chemist making oligonucleotides for molecular biologists to use, and there was no real hierarchy there, but if anybody had said, well, who's the coolest people here, it would have quickly been the molecular biologists, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not the chemists. They were just here in a service capacity. So that didn't help in terms of convincing people that I had come up with something that would replace a lot of the work that they did. And the fact that it would replace a lot of that actually was not something they wanted to hear anyhow. The scientists are kind of like that. They're territorial, and they're not always out there looking for the latest, hottest-looking thing, you know. And they're very seldom looking into other fields for that thing that they really, you know, maybe will be able to use. I mean, usually, if you follow a scientist into a poster session, for instance, at a meeting, you can be pretty well assured that he's going to pay most of his attention to the posters that have everything to do with what he does himself, and pay absolutely no attention to the posters from people that do something completely different. I have a backwards way of doing it. When I go through a poster session, I make a quick sweep through there and find the one poster that I consider the one most mystifying, the one that I don't know anything about. Because in those kind of situations, there's usually somebody there who can tell you what that's about, if you're, you know, at least explain to you why you don't understand it. But that's not a typical, you know, you could try that sometime in a meeting with, you know, and publish it in genetic engineering news and say, we asked people what was their subspecialty kind of, and then we followed them and we say they spent 92% of their time looking at the work of three of their best known colleagues kind of, and paid no attention whatsoever to the rest of it.
So you're kind of saying that the conservative have a narrow focus. Now, in view of this lack of enthusiasm by a lot of these scientists, why were you so certain that PCR is going to become a cornerstone of life science research?
I mean, if you think about the steps of PCR, all of those individually had been done before. I was making oligonucleotides, in fact, so molecular biologists could extend them on single-stranded DNA. I knew that worked. And I said, well, if you can do it once, you can do it twice. And if you can do it with one oligonucleotide in a tube, how's it going to know there's another one in there that's finding the complement and doing it to that? There's no way. So it should work. It didn't make any, it wasn't brand new things. Like, to do the first reactions, I didn't have to order any things that we didn't already have. You know, it was just saying, here's a way to do that, which will give you this result. But it was kind of, there wasn't any new biochemical sort of manipulation that was introduced by the first PCR reaction. It was just, you do this thing that you normally do, you have to do it twice at the same time, and you do it in the same tube, and then you do it again and again and again. All that was kind of new, but it wasn't new.
Dr. Mullis, in one chapter in your book, you appear to be saying that scientists doing basic research have become somewhat beholden to the dictates of large funding agencies and other bureaucratic organizations. I look at it as if they are kind of hostage to the needs of these huge groups. How do you think this current state of affairs regarding funding impacts scientific research?
Well, I mean, the way I look at it is that it's become more and more sponsored by big organizations, and just like biochemistry has been sponsored by more and more biotech companies and stuff. So they have more and more control over what you end up doing, right? But prior to that, it was, well, you're not even going to have the opportunity to do that because there's no funding for it. So when using the word hostage is kind of funny there, but it's controlled by interests that that are not necessarily the same, and curiosities that are not the same as the people actually doing it. Now, I've thought about that a long time. Obviously, you can't have a completely anarchic system where that you know, everybody just does what they want to and somebody pays them. But the best agency I think I've ever worked for was DARPA, you know, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Association, or Projects Agency. And they have a concept there which I like, and that is if more than 90%, I mean, if more than 10% of the projects that you as a project manager are funding work, you're not being wild enough. You know, you're being too conservative. Whereas at NIH or something like that, if just about every time you get money from them and you do something, you've almost already got the thing finished before you even do the grant, right? You've already done so many preliminary experiments and all this that you're not really taking a big chance. You're not leaping out into a... You do that occasionally with money that you got from other grants, sort of, but you don't write them a letter and you say, I got this wild idea that would really be cool if it worked. Would you be interested in funding it? And then NIH would politely say no. They'd say, what kind of preliminary evidence have you got that this would, but this would work, you know? And it'd be, so it's a different kind of a mindset that says you have to be sort of responsible for every time we give you money, you've got to produce something back. There's got to be papers that are published in reputable journals that say, here's what we did with that money. And of course, it worked. Because most of it, actually, the basics of it had already been worked out before you even wrote the grant. I mean, if you really talk to professional scientists, they know pretty much what's going to happen in their experiments before they even write the grant for it. They've got evidence for it. There's not a lot of speculative kind of stuff where somebody's just really shooting in the dark. And although that might, well, that sounds reasonable from a corporate standpoint, it leaves out that element of, hey, I got the wildest idea last night, but you know what? It would take me a year or two to ever get that, you know, funded. And in the meantime, I'd have to work on it to get some more information and stuff with other money that I have to get from somewhere. And that kind of thing for, let's say, a certain percentage of the people that are professional scientists, that's probably a good way to have it. But there's a 10% of them, of people out there, and I'm just making that number up, who, if they have a good idea and if they don't immediately have the ability to start working on it, they get discouraged, and they're not interested in, like, spending the year or two it would take to like, develop some expertise in the area and get some kind of preliminary information and do all that sort of stuff that you have to do, actually, to start exploring a new area.
I want to get to my final question here, and I'd like to know if you can tell our listeners, what are you doing to keep busy now in terms of professional career, and what are your main interests?
Well, the thing that I'm working on in terms of my professional career is I've come up with a way, and so far it's proven to work in the laboratory, whereby you basically can make a chemical that on one end of it has a binding site that will attach itself to some pathogen that you know. Like, for instance, right now we have some experiments going on at Davis trying to cure influenza in chickens, because we know that there's some pretty bad strains of influenza that have a chance of getting here by way of the ducks. And so it'd be nice to have a cure for that. And what I thought about a long time ago, but it took me, this is right about 10 years ago I first thought of this, but it takes a long time to learn immunology, and this has to do with it. But what I was thinking is, if you can make a compound that on one end of it will grab a pathogen specifically, and chemists are really good at doing that now with all kind of combinatorial methods, And then on the other end of the same molecule, you just hang something that you're already very immune to. You already have a working immune response against that thing. Then that little linker will find the pathogen, and it will make it look like, to your immune system, this thing that you're immune to. And I mean, the particular specifics of this that I'm working on right now is that there's a little 9 amino acid feature on the surface of influenza virions and also cells, human cells that are infected with influenza. There's this little 9 amino acid peptide that has for some reason been stable since 1917. That there's not much of influenza that has been, but that particular little peptide has been. And I've thought of all kind of reasons why it probably is, but that's beside the point. It is the same and in every sequence that's been looked at. So I can make a DNA aptamer, which is a kind of it's a single-stranded DNA molecule that will have a lot of different conformations, but which sometimes will bind to a specific structure tightly. And you make these things 10 to the 15th at a time, and you pick the one that works, and then you use PCR to sequence it, and you say, okay, I want to know the sequence of the one that actually stuck to that little nanopeptide. And once you know the sequence of it, you can make lots of it. And then you can figure out, which took us a long time, actually. And again, I'm on this one, one of my collaborators is this guy, Ron Cook, who is the person who long ago in my past sort of put the pressure on me to invent PCR by coming up with the first successful oligonucleotide synthesizer machine. And he still works up in Novato, California. And he's going to work on the part of it that has to do with making the aptamer. And there's a lot of variations of it that are fairly complicated, but because you have to worry about what else does that thing bind to and is it stable in serum and all that kind of stuff. We already had the sequence of an aptamer from this lady in Israel at the Weissman who had made an aptamer that would bind to one, there's a protein on the surface of an influenza virus called hemagglutinin, but that's an extremely variable one, and so you wouldn't want that. That's not a perfect one to be a target for this kind of drug, but in fact it's good enough as far as a test, you know, like an experiment that shows that this does work. So what we've done is made her aptamer just from the sequence that she published, which will bind to a particular strain of influenza, which is a H3N2 strain. It's not particularly harmful to most of us now because we're immune to it, but it will bind to that one, and it will bring in this thing called alpha-gal epitope, which is a little trisaccharide somebody else synthesized, and then Ron figured out how to attach the two together. So in the next couple of months, we're hoping to kill some chickens and save some other ones. And if it works in that particular system, then we'll have a lot more encouragement to continue with that. And I don't really, this is another one of those things where I don't see how it could fail.
I'm John Sterling. Thanks for listening. Now we'd like your thoughts on some of the issues raised during the podcast. Please go to www.genengnews.com/blog and answer the following. Do you think that scientists tend to become too narrowly focused on their own areas of research and expertise? Since so many scientific discoveries take place almost serendipitously, can't a case be made that a broader approach to research would lead to more interesting discoveries? Bye for now.
To learn more about topics discussed in this GenCast, or to listen to previous GenCasts, visit our website at www.genengnews.com. New GenCasts are posted every week, Thursday, 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Next week's guest, Dr. Lawrence J. Wong, Associate Professor of Biology at Brandeis University, discusses qPCR and late PCR. For the Gen Publishing editorial staff, I'm Jonathan Ellinghouse saying thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in again next week to the GenCast Network.